Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
World champion boxer Bernard Dunn has a new radio show. It's been going out on Sunday evenings on Radio 1 at 6 o'clock. It's called Dunn Talking. See what they did there. And each episode features one of Ireland's sporting heroes. Already Bernard has spoken to Niall Quinn and Kelly Harrington. And now we're going to turn the tables and speak to Bernard Dunn. Good afternoon, Bernard.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Congratulations. I've listened to both of them. Very good.
You enjoy it?
Yeah, I think sports people get more from sports people than the rest of us do.
Yeah, quite possibly, yeah.
Yes.
Especially with the Kelly one, because myself and Kelly obviously had a really strong relationship, you know, leading into the interview. And yeah, she was quite open and frank around, I suppose, the challenges that she had faced and kind of the resilience that she needed, especially, you know, during, of course, she's trying to get into sport, you know, and try to get that opportunity. Could you imagine, you know, Kelly may never have actually, you know, graced a boxing ring or had any chance of winning an Olympic medal.
Begs the question, I suppose, how many people are out there who never made it, who could have made it. That's the thing, isn't it?
Well, it's
sliding doors.
taking those opportunities. It's taking those chances when they present themselves. And they always present themselves. Niall told a great story. Did you hear the one where the postal strike was?
Yes,
on?
Yeah.
And he got a contract offer to go to Arsenal. Went over to Arsenal. But then a couple of AFL managers knocked on his front door and said, we didn't hear back. But he never got the letters. There was two contracts sent to him from Australia with better money, better opportunities. And because he never arrived on time, he went over to Arsenal.
And the rest is history.
Well, yeah. One of the contracts that got given out and after Niall didn't take it, Jim Steins got it.
Aha, the great Jim Steins.
And just what an opportunity then presented itself.
Your chat with Kelly is particularly good because you knew each other so well and you're the same sport.
Yeah,
this is a question for you. Did you find it, because did you find it talking to people who were individual sports people as opposed to people who played in a team?
No, well, we've got Mary O'Connor on, we've got James McCarthy on, we've also got Jim Bulger. Jim Bulger is the next episode up, and Jim's an exceptional individual. He talks about his methodology, he talks about his work ethic, what he expects from the standards that he sets. And it seems to be a common team, although they're all from different sports. There's a very common team across high-performing individuals around.
Well, let's talk about those common themes. Mm. Yeah, because that's, I suppose, you've interviewed all of these people now in depth.
Yeah.
So what are the common themes you've seen? Drive, I suppose, is...
Drive is one thing, and it's discipline, dedication. But standards always stand out. You know, they get the basic things done right all the time. You know, they're the things that they don't budge on their standards. And Jim speaks openly around that, around what he expects of himself, but then what he expects from everybody else in his yard, his jockeys, his trainers, he's all his staff. Mm. And Kelly would have been very, very similar. Like, Kelly had a very clear standard of herself, of her training partners, of her coaches, of myself as the leader of the system. And Kelly would have been in and out of my office on more than one occasion, voicing her thoughts around certain situations, and it's my job then to kind of rationalise with her. And
do people sometimes mistake those the standards that people have for them being awkward?
Yeah, absolutely. But like, you got to remember, like, these people are willing to do something that most people will never do, not just physically to their body, but mentally to themselves. Like, the challenges that they go through, the resilience that they show. Like, Niall talks about, you know, the double cruciates, going to the PFA around about to get his pension at 29 years of age, and then a chance meeting, gets a phone call, and his career's back on track.
Mm.
Like, challenges that they all go through. And that transition piece is also a common piece, a common theme, where it can be challenging to step out of your sport, to step away from the thing you know, you love, that you know you can do. I'm managing that. Like, Niall spoke really well on that, and his wife is doing a PhD in it, Gillian, around that athlete transition and kind of relationships.
What about you? Because, like, let's talk about you a bit, because I was just thinking about this over the weekend, that like, most athletes are done by 40, unless you're in something like golf.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of them maybe
darts.
darts. And a lot of them maybe at 30. You know, that's the, and that there's a lot more living to be doing after that.
Oh, you know.
50, 60 years of living. And when you were in the thick of it, when you were winning world championships and been adored by everybody in the, was it the two arena at the time?
It was the old Point.
That's how far back
you go with me, right?
Yeah, were you thinking about the future at all? Were you thinking about the days when you weren't going to be putting on the gloves?
No. And that kind of challenged me when I stepped away from the sport, and I felt I'd left behind the one thing I could actually do, the one that gave me value, gave me purpose, and that kind of transition for me was really, really difficult. And that's why I kind of understood it when I was leading systems around the importance of, okay, well, what does the next step look like? And actually talking with my athletes and talking with the people I work with around, well, what does that look like? How can I help?
And what did it look like for you?
Oh, initially, I came very close to going back.
Did you?
Oh, I did, yeah, very close. But I was lost. I was lost.
And would that have been a stupid thing to do, do you think?
Oh. We'll never know, because I never went back.
Of course,
we'll never know. I got out at the right time.
When you say the right time, is that because you had your health? And
no, because at that stage I stopped really loving it. And you need to love it in its entirety to do it to your best of your ability.
Because there are so many sacrifices involved, I suppose.
Well, there's choices you have to make. And if I wasn't going to make those right choices, there's a potential to get hurt in my sport. And that's the one thing I've been, you know, touch wood, I've been lucky enough to not have taken too much punishment.
Broken nose or?
I broke my nose twice and never broken in boxing.
Right?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
How'd you break it then?
I walked into a set of weights one day and broke my nose.
Oh, that's fair enough.
Yeah, and then I fell on the floor another day and smashed my nose.
Right.
Messing, yeah. So I don't really look stupid, you know.
That's mad, because people would assume when they meet there's a boxer's nose.
Never broken in a boxing.
So you are a boxer and the nose is on your face.
I've been punching the face an awful lot of my life, so it does explain a lot. But no, my nose is not one of those things.
Yeah. So you came out of it like with no brain damage or anything like that?
As far as I'm aware, anyway. But like, I went into it with a cyst on the brain, you know. So I consciously made a decision to box in spite of having... and again, we talk about this sliding doors moment. Like, I was signing a huge deal to stay in Ireland when I was initially turning professional. And I failed a routine medical. I have a cyst in the middle of my brain, but we had no reference point for the cyst. So we couldn't compare it to something, a previous scan. So there was a zero tolerance policy in Ireland and the UK at the time. And so I would have been banned globally if my doctor had released the results. And he didn't release the results, thankfully. And he says, look, he said, I can't vouch. I can't guarantee that it's not something you were born with. But I'm pretty positive it is.
And you weren't allowed to box for a while, were you?
No, I went to America and took a chance. I just didn't tell anybody.
Oh, you didn't, right.
But again, you know, it was a decision.
Then you ended up with Sugar Ray Leonard and,
That would have never happened.
Yeah.
So I trained with Freddie Roach, trained with Sugar Ray Leonard. My sparring partners on a weekly basis were Manny Pacquiao, Israel Vasquez, Johnny Tapia.
So if you hadn't got that diagnosis of a cyst on your brain, you would have stayed in Ireland. It would have been a different story.
Well, we don't know what the story would have been.
But I would
not have been exposed to probably the greatest ever apprenticeship somebody's ever served. Like, I was working with the best in the business and being exposed to
highest levels. What happened with the diagnosis then?
Well, it flagged up again in my second contest in the States. Failed a scan. Failed a scan in Buffalo. I was under the care of Baby Joe Macy, and I heard the doctors talk, we need to see this kid when he's old and grey and has kids of his own. I knew immediately they were talking about me. By this stage, I'd been active as a pro for nearly 2 years. So now I had a reference point from the scan I previously had, and I was able to prove then that, you know, it hasn't changed. But it took me about 2.5 years from start to finish to kind of get cleared. It was a long process.
And boxing, was it always going to be boxing for you? Your dad was a boxer.
I played every sport until I was 14.
Right.
But kind of realised very young that I was different in the ring.
And Neilstown is where you're from.
Neilstown, born and bred. Greatest place on earth, in my opinion. It's a tough place to grow up. You know, if you listen to the media, you know, when I was back in the 80s. but it was fantastic, you know, and I got an opportunity to go boxing because of my dad. And the support I got from the local community was just, and it still is amazing. Yeah, I mean, everything that I do.
Since you started, things have changed seismically in sport. Mm. Like psychology, for example.
Yeah.
That would have been frowned upon, laughed at back in the day. Now it's an integral part of everything elite athletes do, isn't it?
It is. I've gone back and I have a master's in performance psychology. So I've been lucky enough to go back to education when I retired. And it definitely helps when you're working with elite performers, you know, because at that level, everybody's got a certain talent in terms of skill. It's usually the ones that can control the mind, stay calm, literally stay focused. I remember I boxed Kiko, most people would see Kiko as my biggest failure, you know, and, you know, you get knocked out in 86 seconds in front of the world.
Was that in The Point?
That was in The Point, yeah.
So it was a big deal, big news.
Yeah.
My
own ego completely took over.
How so?
Because Kiko was a puncher, but my game was technical. There was this stuff all week around, this guy's going to, you know, big puncher, he's going to be able to outfight him. And I was like, I'd be able to fight this kid, no problem, you know. Lesson learned very quickly. You know, it took 86 seconds for the fight to end. So, but that was all my own ego that literally took over.
Interesting because Kelly Harrington says that she always has to, she wants to convince herself she's an underdog.
Mm. Yeah.
And is that her, and you can't speak for her, but just from talking to her and working with her for 5 years, is that her way of keeping her ego at bay, I wonder?
I don't think so. I think Kelly fully understands herself and
how good
so,
she is.
Oh yeah. You know, so she understands her strengths and she walks from her strengths. You know, she doesn't try to do 100.
Okay, well here's another way of putting that question. Do people have different strategies when they talk to themselves in their heads?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And whatever works for you, I suppose.
For me, it was all about preparation. So I would talk to myself just as I was about to go into battle around what I've done to prepare for this.
Right.
You know, and have I ticked all the boxes? And once I ticked all the boxes, I was ready to go to war. And if your back's against the wall and you know you've got this, I know I can get through this. I think it's when you've missed a couple of beats and you've skipped it. So this was the fear I had when I retired, was that, you know what, I didn't love it as much to commit to, you know, going running when it was, you know, snowing outside.
Yes.
I'd have taken the morning off. Whereas back in the day, I didn't miss anything.
And you were worried then that just that morning off,
yeah,
that was enough to just knock you a little bit off.
And when push comes to shove and you're under pressure and you know you've cut corners,
yeah,
I felt that I'd fall apart at that stage.
Here's the thing my 12-year-old son says to me constantly, and he's obsessed with NBA basketball players, you know, and he must have heard this from somebody, but hard work trumps talent every time.
Well, you can have all the talent in the world, but if you're not training correctly, if you're not focused on what the tactics are, if you're not creating a plan, you may get lucky.
But I suppose what I want to ask you, because you've spoken to all these people and you've worked in, you know, elite sport, and you've worked with the Dublin County team. How long did you work with them for?
7 years.
7 years. So you've seen a lot of talented sports people.
Yeah.
Are they born with that talent?
Oh, no, they do work extremely.
Right.
Like, you look at James McCarthy. James McCarthy's the Rolls Royce of GA players, one of the most decorated players to have ever played a game, and he's probably one of the hardest working anyway that I've ever.
But if he hadn't got
a
basic talent, all that hard work would count for very little, I would argue.
Oh, you need to have talent. Of course, you have to have talent.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can build on it.
Mm.
You can, like, if you've got basic coordination, if you've got functional movement, if you can hop from one foot to the other, you can learn the skill.
Right.
Like, if I got you know, there's not too many, you know, big super heavyweights in Ireland, but if we got, you know, a 6'6" guy who was good coordination, we could teach him how to box.
Right.
Like, you can always teach somebody to do something, but you have to have the basic functional pieces.
Yes.
I think we're probably missing that at a young age in this day and age.
What? Missing what?
Well, kids are not getting exposed enough to kind of basic movement.
Oh yeah.
And I think we can do that at a much earlier stage.
Yeah, there's actually, because I was at a talk a few years ago, is it movement literacy? And I was shocked to know that, you know, a certain percentage, can't remember the exact percentage, of children couldn't throw a ball, for example.
Mm.
Couldn't hop on one leg. That's
shocking.
Worrying, yeah.
No, it is shocking.
Why is that happening, do you think?
I think the world is changing completely, like where Niall Quinn speaks around the days where, and I know of the days myself, just growing up and playing every sport in the road. You know, you're going out from 9 in the morning to 9 at night. I think, you know, kids are probably spending more time on computers and, yeah, you know, social media and watching TV and getting out of bed at 12 o'clock during the summer. Whatever it may be, that changes now. Like it's,
but yet there's a generation who are, I think, going to the gym more often. They're a lot more health conscious. They're drinking less.
That's all aesthetics.
Is it?
Yeah, it's all about looking good. You know, it's you don't need to look good and dance on two legs. Like, you know, it's,
what would have happened to you if you didn't go into boxing, do you think?
I was going to college after Sydney. When I come back from Sydney, I went to college for a year. So I was in Trinity for a year. And then the offers come in to go pro. So I left college and I only went back to college then again when I retired. But I'd have probably continued in education.
Right.
Or I'd have done the sensible thing that all kids did at that age, got myself an apprenticeship.
Right.
Yeah.
So I didn't know you'd gone to India. So I'm thinking that...
You mean, well, you didn't miss me for the last couple of years, yeah, right? Yeah.
2 years in India. Like, yeah. Was it 2 years?
Yeah, that's how I got to grow this beard. You yeah. know? I didn't have, my wife wasn't with me, so I was able to kind of do whatever I wanted at that stage.
Like, and your wife doesn't like the beard, no?
Oh, she loves it now.
Yeah, yeah.
At least she tells me she does.
Yeah. Did you meet the Indian team in Italy when you were in a camp over there? Is that where you met them initially?
We would have trained with them quite a lot, actually. Yes. Yeah, so we created a partnership with them. But when I left the Irish system, so I took a break for about a year at that stage, and India had been chasing me for that whole time, asked me would I come over. So I went over and spent 2 years over there, yeah.
And
so
the aim was what? What did they want you to do?
Make the number one team in the world.
Right.
Well, they have all the ability to do it.
And they've 1.4 billion people.
1.6 billion people.
Right, sorry.
Yeah, and they bring a little kid from Neilstown over to help them with their system.
And is there any tradition of boxing over there?
Oh, like it's one of their top sports.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah. Within 12 months, they were number one team in the world in terms of boxing.
And have they won Olympic medals?
They've only won a couple of Olympic medals, and that's just their problem. They're not consistent enough in terms of their... operating processes and structures and selection processes, right. All these type of pieces.
And did you go over on your own?
Went over on my own, yeah. Well, see, I travelled so much, so...
What age are your children?
Cuiva's doing a leaving cert now.
Right, so we'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah, Cuiva's 18, and Finn is 17.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So he's in fifth year, so she's in sixth year, right. So yeah. We went bang bang and shut up shop.
And you went over to India?
I went over to... My son came over and stayed with me for the last 3 months.
Oh, did he? Right.
He loved it now. He loved it. I think he's going back in December for a wedding. Right. So he's getting invited to weddings and all over there now.
Culturally very different.
Amazing.
Right.
But culturally very different even from state to state over there. It's just such a huge country. And like you'd have monkeys hanging off your balcony and wild dogs around you have lizards running around the room in the house. It's... You know, it's a different world.
Yeah. Did you do any yoga or anything like that?
Yeah, so actually on the campus where we lived, so I was initially in Delhi. Delhi's a bit overcrowded and quite polluted. So I shifted everybody up kind of northwest, up to Punjab. We stayed in a place called Patiala, and we stayed in this big, huge sports campus there. And it was just so, so good. But there was a yoga course on the campus. So we had our own private yoga teachers come over and teach us, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I'm still not touching my toes, but it's...
right.
I'm more flexible and more adapted, more calm than I used to be.
That's what I was just going to say. Has it changed you as a human being?
The whole experience changed me. Just even dealing with the people and... Because I'd have very clear thoughts around how things can look and should look. But also understanding the sensitivities that they've got, even around kind of male and females kind of interacting and kind of managing those pieces. And yeah, it was, I started to learn Hindi while I was over there.
Right.
But my problem was only 60% of the population speak Hindi.
Right. and most of the success?
Loved it.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely loved it.
Okay, your daughter, Cuiva.
Cuiva, yeah, leaving cert.
So, like, come on, you're the motivator. You've worked with Irish boxers who have won Olympic medals. How do you motivate an 18-year-old girl who's going up to a leaving cert? What do you say?
We just encourage her, you know, and allow her to be, like, I've told her not to go to college.
Right.
I've told her to go away, go travel for a year, go see the world, you know, experience things, you know. That's what we've encouraged her to do, but she's enrolled herself in some business and finance course. And again, I'm delighted that Cuiva is very single-minded and does her thing. Right. Always has been.
That's surprising now, your daughter.
Oh, she's very much like her father.
Yeah.
And if she puts her mind to something, she goes after it. So the day she turned 16, she learned, you know, she went and got herself a job. The day she could apply for the driving test, she applied for the driving test. All of these pieces, yes. she's quite like yes, that. Like, right. Whereas my son's a lot more relaxed, a lot more chilled, like his mother.
I think that, and this is generalisation, but I think that often happens with first and second. You know, the firstborn can be a health and safety officer. And then the secondborn sort of...
Yeah, but there's no pressure in our house anyway for Cuiva. Right. She's flying for.
Brilliant. So, Done Talking, it's RT Radio 1, Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock. Very insightful chats between Bernard Dunn and other members of our top elite sports family. Bernard, thanks so much for coming
in.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.